Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
There have been many weeks this year where we just wish 2020 to be over and to start afresh in a new year without COVID or any other challenges. However, this week was a week where I wished I would have had the power to stop time. In just a single week, so much has happened. It is now clear CPRA is adopted and will come into effect on the 1st of January 2023. The Court of Justice of the European Union once again confirmed that consent is not valid when relying upon pre-ticked boxes, and the European Data Protection Board issued its draft recommendations on international data transfers in the wake of the Schrems II ruling. In the meantime, Finland is dealing with a major health-related data breach. The Biden transition team was announced, which includes some privacy-minded people. What will that mean? And the FTC told Zoom to implement a full privacy and security program. And that was just the tip of the iceberg before the Commission dropped the new model standard contractual clauses right at the start of our podcast recording. Luckily, our guest today is a leading international privacy expert with a broad view on all these law and technology issues, and we'll be happy to discuss them with Kay and myself, or at least so we hope. Paul Schwartz is a Jefferson E. Pazer Professor of Law at Berkeley Law School and the director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. He is one of the organizers of the Privacy Law Salon and the Privacy and Security Forum and has authored many privacy books, often together with our previous guest, Daniel Soloff. So let's get talking. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. I am pleased as punch today to have two Pauls on the podcast with me today, but Paul Schwartz I've known for years and is one of my privacy heroes that I look up to. He's simply amazing, and I hope he is prepared for my unexpected question today. And it is, who would play you in a movie about your life?
Oh, that's a good one. So this has actually evolved over the years, but I'm going to go with the classic, which is Tom Hanks. And so I don't know if you can see it now because Tom has gone in one direction and I've gone in the other, I guess. But believe it or not, like back in the days, if you can imagine, like in the 1980s, when I had a big head of curly hair, and I guess Tom did too, actually people would stop me in New York City and kind of scream, Tom, Tom, Tom. So even though we've gone in different directions, I'm going to go with Tom Hanks, I think, the classic choice.
I would not have intuitively thought that, but I don't think I knew you when you had a big head of curly hair.
Life goes on.
I love it. Paul B?
It's a hard one for me, but given that you've likened me before to Harry Potter, I think I should say Daniel Radcliffe.
I think that is a natural choice for you.
Although he must work on his Dutch accent, I guess, because he's way too British.
Oh, there was another actor that came to mind here in the U.S. that you always remind me of that is fantastic. And I'll try to get the name of that and post it and see if the readers agree. I'm going to go with Julia Roberts for myself. There have been a lot of movies that she has been in that other people have said that they could just see me in that role, probably the ones where she's ditzy and running away from stuff. But there's actually a couple of pictures out there that if you put us side by side, we look like we are closely related. That was 50 pounds ago, let's just be honest. But yeah, I think Julia Roberts would be a great choice. I don't know why people think I remind them of Erin Brockovich. It's just an interesting option. So
maybe the activism and the wish to make things right.
Oh, I was thinking, you know, the country bumpkin part, but okay, I'll go with that. Social justice issues. So that segues us wonderfully into the law. So Paul B., where would you, and by the way, listeners, I'm just going to be Pauling all over the place today. So I'll try to differentiate between the two of them, but, you know, cut me a break here if I don't. So Paul
B. At least our voices are not too much alike. That helps to, for the listeners, distinguish who is talking.
It does. So where would you like to start, Paul B.? We have lots of topics that Paul S. can talk about.
So let's maybe start with what Professor Schwartz would make of the outcome of the election and the transition into the Biden government. What can we expect for privacy in 2021 in the U.S.?
Yeah, so this is going to be very interesting. The Biden administration is going to have a lot of issues that it will confront. But I think that the enactment of the CPRA, the California Privacy Rights Act of 2020, also called CCPA 2.0, I think the enactment of that law by California voters in a referendum is going to place some pressure on the Biden administration to try to break the gridlock in Congress and finally enact a federal privacy law.
And what should that law look like? Would it be an omnibus law like the GDPR? Would it be more focused on individual rights like the initial CCPA? Would it contain a private right of action?
Yeah, there are going to be a lot of very tough issues if we're going to get a federal privacy law. And one that I would add to your list, Paul B., is preemption. To what extent, right, should the federal regulator allow states to have stronger requirements? So all of the above, CCPA 2.0 means that California continues to inch a little bit towards a EU-style omnibus law. And so that's a very interesting question. I guess I would also add to the Biden to-do list whether or not there's going to be some kind of reform of FISA 720 and the apparatus of surveillance law in the U.S. in the light of Schrems II. So certainly on their list as well will be whether or not they can do a new agreement following Schrems II invalidating the privacy shield.
Now, Professor Paul, if the ballot initiative can't be changed except by another ballot initiative, I've wondered, and I think, that California can still pass additional laws that don't directly impact CPRA, but that also deal with privacy.
No, my understanding is that the ballot initiative becomes a statute, and the statute can be changed by the legislature, right? But it's always possible, of course, for Alistair McTaggart to gear up again. He was the gentleman behind the two ballot initiatives, CCPA 1.0 and now the CPRA. So,
yeah, I imagine that some people that know him listen to our podcast. So I'm going to say it. I want Alistair McTaggart on my podcast.
Yeah, there you go. So it is possible to change it through the legislative process. So it's subject to majoritarian changes. That being said, it was a popular referendum. And but it is possible something else is after CCPA 1.0, there have been various legislative initiatives that have cleaned up the statutory text. And
right.
It would not surprise me if after the dust settles, CCPA 2.0 just enacted is 50 pages plus. And some of what it does, in fact, is redline CCPA 1.0 and the changes that have been made to it. I could well imagine that after some of the dust settles post-election day 2020, that we get another cleanup in Sacramento of some of the just kind of like loose ends and things that aren't as clean as they should be in the statutory text.
Right. which is something that I really love, the fact that California is leading the way. And of course, Kamala Harris was former Attorney General for California. She actually became my hero, and I'll look up to see if I can find it, when she replied to two airlines about their privacy policies not being compliant with California law. That was one of my favorites. I'm excited about the possibilities on a federal level, but I'm still excited about what California is going to do. It seems to always lead the way.
Yeah, so this has really been a major development in the last 5 years. And so before CCPA 1.0, California had really interesting, you could say, like odds and ends of privacy law.
And there's lots of odds and ends.
Yeah. And there's a there's a great resource that the Attorney General of California's website of California privacy laws.
Yes.
And for privacy practitioners out there, I really recommend that if you have a matter that involves the personal information of California residents, that you start off or at some point in the process, you look at that website and you just make sure there's not a California odds and end that affects you. So for example, There's California regulation involving rental car information. There's California information, of course, the California Medical Information Act, which in some ways is stricter than HIPAA, in other ways is just different.
Right.
And so that is a very important resource. But Kay, absolutely, California has taken on a prominent role in the entire world with these privacy laws because, as I said, they're starting to inch towards being an omnibus statute. And then the other thing I would add, and something, so CPRA does all kinds of kind of interesting things, but perhaps one of the most important, I think, is to set up a California Data Protection Authority.
And
So the new kid in town, right? And so in the past, we've had a very active role by the Attorney General, and you've referenced Kamala Harris, and that role has continued. We also have privacy and privacy enforcement unit at the Department of Justice, with some of my wonderful former students at Berkeley Law playing a prominent role there. But so now we're going to have this new data protection agency, the California Privacy Protection Agency.
Which is exciting. I've heard a lot of privacy people are not very thrilled with that concept. We've talked about it a couple of times on the podcast, but I have to admit publicly, and I've done before,
absolutely,
I like the idea of a privacy agency.
And it could lead to full membership in the international conference, the Global Privacy Assembly, where the FTC is, of course, a member, but always has to be a bit restrained because of their mandate on privacy issues. So they can't vote and debate on all the resolutions that are put forward within the Global Privacy Assembly, which would be completely different for the California Privacy Protection Agency. So I also think it is a big step forward, also for one of the top 10 economies in the world, to show we have an enforcement agency of our own, independent, well-staffed, well-resourced. A lot of European member states could learn from the well-resourced side.
Probably could. And we've had Lillian on the show before, who's the chief privacy officer for the county of LA. And I'm going to get her back on because I want to hear her reaction to as well to what's going to go on with California. Probably be early 2021, but that ought to be interesting.
Okay, if I can ask you a question, tell me what excites you about the agency? All ears.
I should say there's rules here. You're not allowed to ask me questions.
Oh, okay.
Of course, it's a conversation.
I like the fact that for me, establishing an agency to oversee a particular area of law actually gives more legitimacy and more power to making that area more established. I don't know that I'm saying it right, but, you know, HIPAA became a big thing because the Office for Civil Rights enforces HIPAA. And so people pay attention to HIPAA. FERPA, they don't pay attention to so much. But HIPAA, they pay attention to because there's an agency that oversees that. And some of the pushback on the agency is that we have plenty of good enforcement under the FTC. And when Travis LeBlanc was at the FCC, we had plenty of enforcement under the FCC. Superman and Batman, they're all battling for the good. But I think even if the California's consumer privacy agency doesn't inspire other states to create the same thing, I think it might actually have an impact on the federal government. And so I think that's what excites me about it, is because it will make it a bigger issue. Once you have an agency and you have a budget that's their sole focus, then privacy becomes a central issue that's talked about.
Yeah. And let me just maybe add 2 points. You may just issued a shout out to Travis LeBlanc, great guy. And
yes,
Travis, if you listen to this, I hope your ears are burning, as they say in the South, right?
Yes. So,
kudos to you. And Travis was actually the technology advisor to Kamala Harris when she was 18.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to go back to what Kay was saying about kind of California leading the way, it has certainly kind of led the way in developing and encouraging privacy talent. So Travis
yes.
went from technology advisor, which is at the time when I met him, and went on to an important role at the FCC. He's on the President's Civil Liberties Oversight Board now and in private practice. So that's been very exciting. And of course, by the way, so I mentioned that he was technology advisor. There's really been an important role in California in other areas of kind of tech and internet regulation and oversight. And a great example would be Kamala Harris's very important role in fighting image-based mm-hmm. sexual abuse, also
right.
known sometimes as revenge porn.
Yes.
And so very important role there. And then Attorney General Harris did a great job at bringing the tech community to the table, also leading scholars of image-based sexual abuse and harm to women, like Danielle Cetron.
Yep.
Attorney General Harris and then Senator Harris and now Vice President-elect Harris really has a great track record of bringing these different kinds of entities together. And also, I think, being sensitive to the harms that the digital environment can.
You know, and I had not thought about this in a long time, Paul. Revenge porn is one of my critical topics in privacy. We did a podcast on both of our favorite topics, and revenge porn is one that I follow. I had completely forgotten that I became intrigued with revenge porn at one of your conferences that you held at Berkeley. I don't even want to remember how many years ago. And I heard Danielle Cetron speak on it. And so that's when I actually started paying more attention to the legal and the privacy and the technology aspects of revenge porn and paying attention to that. So you're right, because Kamala Harris, I just want to just call her Kamala because I just feel like we could be best friends. Everybody does, right? I'd carry her briefcase in a heartbeat. And I'd carry Travis LeBlanc too,
goes
by
to
the
Washington.
Way. But yes, so she was attorney general when all of the social media giants finally agreed to start implementing protections for removing non-consensual pornography from their sites. They used to have to jump through a million hoops to be able to get someone to take it down. And so she was actually very active in getting them to put in protections for it. I had forgotten about that part. Thank you for the reminder.
Yeah, and that was as you're describing it, Kay, that was a kind of negotiation. And Danielle Cetron was actually one of the advisors to the then Attorney General Harris. It was really a great effort. And so I hope that predicts future negotiations and efforts to get privacy legislation, to return to your previous point. And then to say something else about this new data protection agency, the California Privacy Protection Agency. And I think, Kay, your instinct is I would agree with it, that it's exciting. And I think one of the things that's exciting here is there's this saying, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck.
Right.
I think it's going to be very helpful as part of the international dialogue around privacy issues. If we have an agency in the United States that looks like a European agency,
right?
And so And so this goes back to a suggestion that Robert Gellman made years ago. And Robert Gellman had a longstanding role in the House as a staff member.
Yes.
Working on privacy member. He's now a consultant. Robert, years ago, first in his own kind of policy advocacy and then in a law review essay, argued strongly that it was a mistake for the United States not to have a privacy agency of some kind at the federal level. And his argument always, you know, when he would get cynical about it, would be it doesn't even have to be that powerful, right?
Just has to exist.
Just has to exist. It has to look somewhat like a EU-style agency, many of which at the time, going back decades now, were considerably weaker than in their current formulation. But his argument was, get U.S. people at the table, at the EU member, at the EU meetings, and that will help us because we will have a voice. And so fast forward to 2020, we do have the FTC at the table, but it is not quite the same kind of entity.
No, true.
As a federal, as an EU agency, due to limitations on jurisdiction.
I don't know if it is the European side or the American side, but the relations between the European Data Protection Board and Trade Commission are not as good as they were some years ago. I recall when I was still with the Working Party 29 and when Jakob Kunstam was still the chair, we had buy-ins with at least Julie and Edith Ramirez, who were at the FTC at the time, either in Washington or in Brussels or online. But there would be at least two meetings a year with the Federal Trade Commission and the Working Party 29. And I think meetings like that have not happened since the European Data Protection Board was established.
That's interesting. And so that is something that I know that Julie Brill, as an FTC commissioner, plays great value and importance on. And so that's going to be also, if we go from California to the FTC, you know, with the Zoom investigation this week.
That was interesting to come out, wasn't it? I mean, it reads like a recipe for what you should do.
Yeah. And what I find very interesting is, so we have had a series of strong dissents in very important recent FTC decisions, including, by the way, Facebook decision from 2019, where we have Commissioner Chopra saying the $5 billion fine is not enough.
Right.
And we have Commissioner Slaughter saying, I would roll the dice and go to court, folks.
Right.
And so this is fascinating because now with the Biden administration, we're going to shift from a 3-2 Republican FTC to a 3-2 Democratic FTC. And so the question that I have in my mind when I read these opinions, do we now have a majority for various Chopra and Commissioner Slaughter dissents? And if so, that is going to be a game changer. And I should add as well, so at the FTC, the question in my mind post-2016 was, does the pendulum now swing in a different direction? There was a very interesting Nomi case where there's a dissent and it involved a small startup and they were found to have made privacy promises that they didn't upheld. So it's kind of standard case, but we had very strong dissents from then Commissioner Wright, GOP member of the FTC, and then Commissioner Olhausen. And so the question in my mind was, does the center now hold when we get that third Republican voice? And of course, in 2016, the entire FTC changed over. And so the cards kind of got reshuffled. But what was interesting is we really saw the same kind of actions taking place as before, which from one perspective might be seen as a disappointment and too incremental. But my takeaway was that it was really fascinating that there was essentially kind of a confirmation of what Dan Solove and Woody Hartzog have called the common law of the FTC regarding privacy. They kept doing pretty much what they were doing before. And so now my question is, to my mind, we could really see big changes with the Democratic majority.
We have opportunity because every administration has their own priorities of what they want to focus on during their administration. And you can't fault them for that. That's the nature of administrators. They have their own priorities, and the privacy has not been a priority. Let's be honest, it's not a priority for a lot of people in the United States. Why would it be a priority for our administration?
It's
but
not completely
we have
true.
A promise now.
Well, we have a promise, and everybody is really excited about what a Biden administration brings. So am I. I'm hopeful. At the same time, what is really this time around, because also the Obama White House really pushed hard and tried to get privacy action on the books.
And there was a lot of enforcement.
Yeah, I recall the discussions on the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, which ultimately failed. So what is different this time around that would make privacy legislation at a federal level more likely?
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm very bad predicting political tea leaves. There are definitely people who are sitting in Washington, and that's what they do.
Yeah.
And I'm so bad at that. I do think, as I mentioned before, that the CPRA may create pressure.
Yeah.
And so for a federal solution. So what happens here traditionally in legal thought and political science thought is the so-called flight to Washington. And so this was reported in Law Review article by Robert Ellickson going back to the 70s. And his examples were from environmental law. And so that you get California leading the way, protecting air pollution, right, with enormous problems, particularly in Southern California at that time. So you get California laws, then the industry looks at it and thinks, oh my gosh, it's going to be hard to deal with a patchwork of regulation. And plus, we don't necessarily like the California solution. And that brings everybody to the table in Washington. And you get a federal law in the Clean Air Act. You also got California grandfathered so they could have their own emission standards.
Which is what they want on pretty much across the board.
Right. And again, the preemption issue. And so that traditionally has worked. It didn't happen, though. It hasn't happened yet in privacy legislation. Interestingly enough, it hasn't happened for data security legislation.
Right.
And so what happened there, data security legislation is we now have 50 data breach laws, but we don't have a federal law. So why is there no flight to Washington? And I think what has happened is that regulated parties have by and large discovered that they can deal with 50 state regulations. And so typically at law firms, at privacy consultants, there's the quote unquote matrix.
Yeah.
And all kinds of products and services with industry responding very efficiently, the privacy industry to this. So if you have a 35 state breach, there are all kinds of products and services out there. So you can deal with that efficiently. And so for people who have data breaches, the thought is, let's not open up Pandora's box and get a federal law because we may not like what we get. Let's just deal with the higher transaction costs of 50 state laws. Okay, so relate this then. If you think about federal privacy legislation, that's the issue. Does this CPRA now and all these other kinds of state laws that are out there make it so costly for the regulated parties so that they're thinking, oh my gosh, make the pain stop, give us a federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think we're going to see over the next 4 years.
Oh, that would be interesting. And I have my favorite breached state data breach notification chart that I like to use as well. But a lot of law firms and consulting firms put those out, so they're easy enough to find for people. And one of my favorite resources is the National Conference of State Legislatures, which actually you can look for privacy on there, and it will give you all the different state laws under all kinds of different privacy elements, including the, remember back when employers were asking for applicants' social media logins so they could log into their social media, which was really weird, but it was a thing. But this also might spur the other states. We did see the states back off of privacy laws that we thought were going to be a thing in 2020, and they were not. No surprise once you look back on it that it was not big election year. Of course, it's not going to be a priority, but we were hoping that the U.S. states were going to start passing laws, and then maybe you would start seeing a bigger conflict. I don't think state data breach notification laws have a huge conflict. There's a few differences between them, but it's not a big conflict. I think the biggest part is the fact that they can enforce against them individually. So if you have a US-wide data breach, then you have to deal with 50 or 50 plus regulators in the various states coming after you, the attorneys general, the Department of Consumer Affairs, the Department of Insurances. There's various agencies in the states that do it. But I would think that privacy laws on the state basis would probably vary much greater than data breach notification laws would.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that will start.
We'll see. Like, so that's very interesting. There's a really wonderful article. The lead author is Anup Chander of Georgetown Law Center. He and his co-authors of the article's coming out in Minnesota in 2020, so later this year. I don't know if he's furiously now updating for the CPRA, but his argument, it's called Catalyzing Privacy Law.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, our argument is that it's the CCPA that has been extremely influential in the U.S. and, in fact, not the GDPR.
Right.
And so one of the interesting things the authors did in the paper is they've looked at some of the draft legislation coming in from different states and they argue that if you look at it, it's really not GDPR. It's really all about the CCPA. So, right. Okay, that speaks to your point about are we going to get something that's kind of very different from the different states, or is it going to be the California solution enacted 49 times?
I think that's right. Also, from what I've seen from the legislation, of course, as a European, I regret that the GDPR model is not more widely embraced in the United States.
Not to ever mention that at all.
No, of course not. MSK knows one of my biggest is that CCPA, so CPRA, is limited to California residents and not using the wider concept of privacy as a fundamental right to everyone, notwithstanding their nationality or place of residence. As soon as their data is processed, in my view, they should be protected. But maybe that is something that could be coming in a couple of years. Because that is also part of the bigger discussion, of course, between the EU-US system and then slowly moving this discussion also towards the discussion. That's something that a new US government might be able to solve, or shouldn't right. we get our hopes up here in Europe? Again, more tea leaf reading.
Yeah, and just to speak to why do these laws only protect California residents? And that's going to be a Commerce Clause and Federalism issue. So in California, there are limits to the California power. So California can't say, guess what? We are now going to regulate data use in Rhode Island, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's a matter for Rhode Island. And so, right. And similarly, this is an argument in the EU as to kind of what the EU is allowed to regulate and what they leave to the member states, right? That's kind of the hook for the California legislation, that it has to be California residents. Of course, California is such a big market pull, as right. you mentioned. So I think what the hope of some is that companies will just use that as the benchmark.
Right.
And they'll say, rather than comply with all this patchwork, or alternatively, if there's not a regulation in some given state, they may decide it's just better and cheaper to do what we do in California so that we have a simplified system.
Now, I was going to say, don't we have a little bit of a precedent for that in Texas law? I think under their medical information law, maybe it's related to breach. I haven't looked at it in a while, but they actually have a provision that if a Texas company has a breach and there are residents of other states that don't have a law like Texas that would protect them, then Texas law would cover that as well. Not sure it's been tested, but I think it's in the books.
Yeah, so that's really fascinating.
I'll find that. Yeah, because that was an unusual one there because of our federalism and how that's set up. But like I said, I don't know if it's been tested. But again, that's Texas. Yeah. So
that's really fascinating. And to speak to whether or not the transfer issue is going to be on the agenda of the new administration, absolutely. And I don't think they have much of a choice. I think industry is going to put pressure on the Biden administration to kind of get the negotiations going with the EU and to figure out kind of like where is a deal possible. And so you mentioned so much is happening in the world of data protection now. Mm-hmm. And I think back to, you know, to two decades ago where there would be an article in the New York Times or somewhere about privacy and my mom would cut it out for me. And mail to me in an envelope and kind of say, hey, isn't this the area?
Here's your thing.
Yeah, isn't this your thing? And sometimes, because there were so few articles about privacy in those days, I'd sometimes get articles about database protection, which is IP, but, you know, kind of close. And my mom's not a lawyer. And then at
right.
one point, fast forward, she said, you know, there's so many articles about it. I give up. You're going to have to find them yourself.
So I went to, well, that's a good problem to have, right?
Exactly. So there went my research assistance from mom. But
oh, that is awesome. But it does bring an interesting thing, which pity on me that this didn't occur to me. Do you believe that there is a possibility that the negotiations for replacing SHIELD has slowed down to see what the administration they're going to be working with would be?
Yeah, it could be. It's a big kind of ticket item and a complex item. And likely it's going to take time. It was interesting with the background of the privacy shield, where the initial prognosis was that it was just going to be a safe harbor 2.0.
Right.
Right. And then Schrems 2 was released by the Court of Justice of the EU and a lot more power to the EU negotiators at that point because there was no more safe harbor. So, okay, right. I think you're right that, you know, if you put yourself in the shoes of the EU negotiators, like, why not wait and see what happens
right.
in the election? And you might have people who are more beneficial for the negotiations on the other side of the table.
Yeah, if there's even a slightest possibility that you might be in a better negotiating position in 2 months, why not wait on that? Which I'm sure it hasn't been completely waited on. I am sure there's been communications back and forth in an attempt. But frankly, if there's a possibility, then why not wait on that? That makes more sense. I hadn't thought about that, but it makes more sense. I mean, a lot of us in privacy have been waiting to see for the promise of what might happen.
But even then, it won't be easy, even with the Biden administration, to find a solution. Because let's not forget that the privacy shield was negotiated under the Obama government.
Yeah.
And also at the time, it was very difficult to obtain any commitment on surveillance and change. And looking at the makeup of the Senate, which is at least Republican, and not all Democrats would be as lenient as we should be in this reform. Even then, I think it will be very difficult to get a deal that would stand the test of the Court of Justice of the European Union.
Yeah, I agree.
The politics, let me say something back as I read it in D.C. around surveillance reform, and then something maybe about this new opinion from or recommendation from the European Data Protection Board, if I may. So the politics of Pfizer are complicated in the U.S. right now. The normal split where you might see Republicans as being very averse to Pfizer changes and Democrats being perhaps more open to it, has really changed. The Trump administration hates Pfizer because of what they went through in terms of what they view as being unfair surveillance in 2016.
Right.
There was a major investigation of the FBI's Crossfire Hurricane, and the Office of the Inspector General found that there were lots and lots of errors, you know, some more technical than others. And that led to a second Office of the Inspector General investigation.
Right.
Where they looked at 20 Pfizer orders and they found some errors in all of them. So Congress is open to do something with Pfizer. There are actually some parts of Pfizer that got sunset recently. Congress just would not agree to, I was surprised, to reenact them. And in part, it was because the Republicans just didn't want to get Trump mad about rolling this over and figured they would wait too and see what happened. So Pfizer, I think there's possibility in the new Congress for some changes. And then second,
well, that'd be worth looking forward to.
Yeah, it could be a very productive period for Pfizer reform.
Yeah.
And then the next kind of interesting, and this is why I referenced how there's just so much coming out of the fire hose of privacy law developments. So the European Data Protection Board yesterday, recommendations on measures that supplement transfer tools to ensure compliance with the EU level of protection. So this is the European Data Protection Board, right?
Yes.
What's fascinating here, and now all privacy world is trying to interpret this, and what do they mean? What are they saying? I noticed today we had some of the big law firms coming out with their guidances.
Paul B., how often have you read this now?
Twice. And getting ready to start a common trajectory. The TrustArk blog should be tonight. So when the episode drops, the TrustArk as well. It's hard because there is, for a lot of regular business activities, there is no easy way out. Also, according to the European Data Protection Board, cloud storage, there are no envisageable measures that you can take to meet standards. Even processing my personal data be problematic by TrustArk, because as an employee, my personal data needs to be processed by the US office, so they cannot just be in Europe. And even that is already problematic under the transfer
regime. So, Paul, you know, I totally read it the same way. I'd actually like to hear more about your thoughts on that, because what I read, you know, now I'm reading what kind of big law is saying about it in their guidances, and they kind of are downplaying that.
Well,
they're U.S. law firms.
Yeah, they are U.S. They are U.S. law firms, so they should be downplaying that from their perspective. Of course, this is still the consultation version. So let's say that first. And I think anybody who has it should consider putting in a response of November. I think that'd be important. But looking at the draft, they've taken a very legalistic approach, which I also expect them to do, interpreting the GDPR along the lines of the verdict of the Court of Justice and also earlier rulings of the Court of Justice, but also without looking, at least in my view, to the factual situation. There are many scenarios on the basis of international data transfers, which are not risky in my view, like my employee data being processed by a US company, and I cannot even consent to it because consent is invalid
in
context, that probably should not be considered as too problematic. The other thing that I believe is problematic, and that is certainly something for the response, is that there is approach in this. The GDPR was designed from the outset as a law based on risk assessments. And here suddenly it's fully black.
Right.
You cannot even say, okay, it is not so likely that the US authorities or the Chinese authorities or the Australian authorities or wherever, that they would access the personal data that I put to that country. No, if the theoretical possibility exists that the data might be accessed, it is already a no-go if you cannot have the supplementary.
Yeah, I was surprised at their lack of a pragmatic approach, because that's one thing I've always appreciated about the European data protection authorities, is they have a very pragmatic and practical approach. I mean, very strong, but still very practical. And I didn't see a whole lot of practical in this one.
No, but let's not forget that also the balance of power within the European Data Protection Board has shifted. The experience of commissioners is different now than it was at the time when we discussed the Privacy Shield and Susharms 1. A lot of the more realistic voices without being,
I like the way you put that.
Well, I mean, without being mean to any of my former colleagues, because I do respect them for their position. The time with Peter Hastings and Giovanelli and David Smith and Jakob Konstan and Isabel Falke, we had commissioners who were also really realistic in what should be done. I think by now, the more active voices are more hardliners on the fundamental right. Which is understandable, which is, from one perspective, really good. I value the fundamental rights per GDPR. but it is problematic on a day-to-day basis when you look at business continuity. And with that, at the top of the hour, time flies by when you have so much to discuss.
Right.
And that means that we need to wrap up another episode of Serious Privacy. Thank you, professors, for being with us today. To our listeners, if you like our series, please rate and review us in your podcast application and do tell your friends and colleagues about us. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Thank you again for listening to this week's episode. A few more until the end of the year. So we hope to hear you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye, Al.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.